Prologue. Rain, rust, and rejection. Seattle did not invent grunge on purpose. It leaked out of the ground, like mold. Before the flannel, before MTV, before the word grunge became a marketing adjective, the Pacific Northwest was a place people left. It was wet, dark, and far from everything that mattered in American culture. New York had money. Los Angeles had image. Nashville had polish. Seattle had rain and layoffs. In the early 1980s, the Boeing plant was shedding workers, logging towns were collapsing, and young people were inheriting an economy that had quietly given up on them. Rent was cheap because opportunity was not. Warehouses stood half empty. Basements echoed. Clubs were small, violent, and loud. This was not a place you went to become famous. It was a place you went when you had nothing to lose. The sound that would later be called grunge grew from that condition. It was not designed. It was not planned. It was not a genre looking for a label. It was what happened when punk kids listened to Black Sabbath, when metal kids learned three chords, and when nobody had enough money for proper gear. Amplifiers were blown. Drums were cheap. Strings buzzed. Feedback became part of the music because it could not be removed. This was not rebellion as fashion. This was noise as necessity. Seattle's geography mattered. Cut off from the major touring routes, isolated from record executives, and trapped under months of gray skies, musicians were left alone with one another. Scenes didn't splinter as quickly. Bands shared bills, shared rehearsal spaces, shared equipment, and shared influences. Ideas spread like viruses. And the dominant idea was pretty simple. Pretty was a lie. The 1980s were obsessed with perfection. Pop stars looked sculpted. Hair metal bands dressed like aliens. Synthesizers promised the future. Music videos sold fantasy. Everything shimmered. Everything smiled. Everything pretended that America was winning. But in the Pacific Northwest, winning looked different. It looked like unemployment checks. It looked like part-time jobs. It looked like rain-soaked boots and beer-soaked basements. It looked like kids who did not recognize themselves in the mirror of MTV. So they built a new mirror. They took punk's anger, but slowed it down. They took metal's heaviness, but stripped away its virtuosity. They sang about boredom, self-disgust, addiction, and confusion. They rejected stage costumes. They rejected guitar solos. They rejected the idea that music needed to sound expensive. What emerged was not a style, but a refusal. A refusal of glam, a refusal of spectacle, a refusal of aspiration. Grunge was the sound of people who did not believe in the dream they were being sold. The early bands didn't call it grunge. They called it rock, or punk, or just noise. Groups like the Melvins, Green River, the U-Men, Skin Yard, and later Mudhoney and Soundgarden were not united by a manifesto. They were united by conditions, cold weather, cheap rent, and the shared sense that the mainstream had nothing to say to them. If New York punk was a scream against the city, and Los Angeles metal was a fantasy of power, Seattle's music was something quieter and heavier. A long, slow exhale. The Melvins, formed in the small logging town of Montesano, slowed punk to a crawl and made heaviness into a joke and a weapon at the same time. They showed that ugliness could be intentional, that slowness could be aggressive, that distortion could be meditative. They influenced nearly everyone who followed, including a shy kid named Kurt Cobain, who would carry their sound into history by accident. Yes, accident. Because grunge was never meant to be exported. It was a local language, a dialect of frustration, a weather system. It belonged to clubs like the Crocodile Cafe and the OK Hotel,